Some people feel their vision of what a thug is has been confirmed by a court, and now they have a right to be suspicious of people like Trayvon Martin.
George Zimmerman has been acquitted, but the jury is still out on what it means to America. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This month, a decades-old ban on domestic access to American foreign propaganda has been revised.
The notion of somehow the Broadcast Board of Governors having some sort of control over what information we as Americans receive, in this era, it's absurd.
Also, in the murky world of paid content, where it's hard to tell the ads from the news, one big public relations firm is trying to set some ethical guidelines.
We're going to make sure that people who are working with journalists day to day are not also negotiating paid media buys.
I feel safer already. There's more OTM after this.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is a free service of WNYC Radio. Go to onthemedia.org to find out where On the Media is playing in your area and to support your local public radio station. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. That's from a protest in Times Square last Sunday, the day after George Zimmerman was found not guilty of second-degree murder in the shooting death of 17-year-old Trayvon Martin. Protests like this occurred all across the country, mostly peacefully. In the streets, on the airwaves, and even in the White House, we are drawing conclusions from that verdict based on our own beliefs, our own experiences.
I think justice failed Trayvon Martin and the Martin family.
They overcharged George Zimmerman, I believe, largely because of outside political pressure.
There are very few African-American men in this country who haven't had the experience of being followed when they were shopping in a department store. That includes me.
We've brought back Tampa Bay Times media critic Eric Deggans, who predicted last week that the issue of race in America, underplayed in trial coverage, would now rush to the fore. But since the public has only one side of the story of what happened on that fateful day in a Florida gated community, Zimmerman's side, everyone is filling in the puzzle with their own pieces, shaped by sorrow or vindication, and acting accordingly.
In some ways, the circus is in town, man. Protests, threats of boycott, people saying this never should have been brought to trial in the first place. All of it is a reaction to the frustration that comes from not being able to really know what sparked the fight between these two people. And that means we can't really put it in context. I mean, the word thug is becoming a polite way of saying the N-word. They're describing a certain type of black person who they feel is young, prone to violence and crime. Some people feel their vision of what a thug is and what a thug means has been confirmed by a court, and now they have a right to be suspicious of people like Trayvon Martin.
Race riots seems to be a bit of a code, too.
Yeah, I think law enforcement would have been crazy to not at least say, okay, it's possible that some hot-headed people might get out of hand if they get frustrated about this verdict, and let's just make sure we're prepared for that. But to suggest that these people, quote unquote, are unruly and violent, and that that's part and parcel of the ethic of people who feel that George Zimmerman should go to jail, that is unfair and prejudiced. It feeds into this idea that some particularly conservative commentators have, that we now have this quote unquote thug mentality that is somehow seeking unfair recompense from the government or unfair attention from the criminal justice system.
And you said last week that once the jurors come forward, we might have some insight into how the decision was arrived at. And so far, only one has come forward anonymously on Anderson Cooper's show. We're going to play a little bit of that.
Okay.
Do you think Trayvon Martin played a role in his own death? This is something he also...
Oh, I believe he played a huge role in his death. When George confronted him and he could have walked away and gone home, he didn't have to do whatever he did and come back and be in a fight.
And the other jurors felt that as well?
They did.
Four out of five of the other jurors said, hold on, anonymously,
right,
we don't feel that way. So what kind of insight can we derive from that remark?
This juror seems to have believed George Zimmerman's story, that George Zimmerman was justified in defending himself. And she also said during that interview that the state's stand-your-ground laws influenced at least her decision, and she believes it influenced the entire jury's decision.
So here I want to bring in Attorney General Eric Holder, who has been described, at least in the Washington Post, as being the voice of the president on controversial racial issues. He was discussing stand your ground.
These laws try to fix something that was never broken. There has always been a legal defense for using deadly force if, and the if is important, if no safe retreat is available. But we must examine laws that take this further by eliminating the common sense and age-old requirement that people who feel threatened have a duty to retreat outside their home if they can do so safely.
George Zimmerman says that Trayvon Martin was beating his head into the sidewalk, fighting to gain control of Zimmerman's gun. So if he's on the ground, he doesn't have the ability to retreat. And that's why Zimmerman's defense team said that stand your ground didn't even need to be invoked. Holder is coming to the NAACP and saying, I sense your outrage about Trayvon Martin. Let's handle the stand your ground laws. That's a wonderful thing to address, but it wouldn't have resulted in a conviction for George Zimmerman, I don't think. If you want to address that, then you got to find something else. What can we do to change things so that that can't happen again? I wish we could have these kinds of discussions outside of the polarizing confines of a really, really controversial and frustrating verdict. I did a story that was on the front page of our newspaper on Monday about all of this, and some of the emails I got from people, it's like the Zimmerman verdict let some people feel free to express their opinions about young black males in ways that were so prejudiced that it was really disheartening. Some people came to that column and felt like I was disrespecting the verdict, that I was demanding that the judge release those jurors' names. They took the argument I was making and amplified it because of their own prejudices.
I'll read the last line of your column, which is incredibly inflammatory. You wrote, I hope the jury reconsiders their stance and talks to America about how they reached their verdict, because damaging as it may be for them to go public, it may be the only thing which can help heal the country. Shame on you, Eric.
I know. But now it's a Rorschach test, and people can come to that column and they can accuse me of all the excesses that I'm trying to resist, because they're not really reading the column. They're seeing what they want to see. And that makes me wonder what happened when Trayvon Martin was walking home. And did George Zimmerman see what he wanted to see? And how do we address that? Can we even address that in laws? Can we address that at all? The problem that we have with the Zimmerman-Martin case ultimately is that on its face, it seems to be a very simple issue. An unarmed black teenager was lawfully where he should be, and he wound up dead. But the details of their confrontation and the most important fact that no one saw how that fight started make it a much more complex issue than we would have thought. Now, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, a month, 2 months from now, well, we still want to have these kind of conversations when everything's died down and we can really get down to brass tacks. That's the question.
Mm-hmm. Eric, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Eric Deggans is a media critic for the Tampa Bay Times and author of Race Baiter, How the Media Wields Dangerous Words to Divide a Nation.
This week, ABC announced a new co-host for its popular morning chat show, The View. Jenny McCarthy, nude model turned comedian turned author turned autism quacktivist, will join Barbara Walters on the all-female panel show in September. No doubt she'll be a lively addition. She's not afraid to do fart jokes, and it's not as though the conversation is too lofty for her.
I don't think anything predated Christians.
No. Yes. The Greeks came first. Yes, the Greeks came first. Then the Romans, then the Christians.
Jesus came first before them,
But in the press release announcing the hire, ABC revealed something chilling. McCarthy, the network said, will stir things up with her parenting beliefs. Uh-oh.
Jenny McCarthy's most notorious parenting belief is the extremely inflammatory allegation that vaccinating children is dangerous, based on some long discredited pseudoscience linking the preservatives in childhood vaccines to autism. Here was McCarthy a couple years back with Larry King.
Isn't the problem here, Jenny, that people sometimes casual or listen with one ear are going to panic and not vaccine at all?
Probably, but guess what? It's not my fault. The reason why they're not vaccinating is because the vaccines are not safe.
Thanks to McCarthy's huge media profile, untold numbers of mothers have foregone the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine and others for their children, with potentially catastrophic public health consequences. Outbreaks of measles and pertussis in the U.S. over the past 5 years, after decades of virtual eradication, underline the stakes. Yet here was McCarthy with Oprah Winfrey explaining her credentials for dispensing medical advice.
When I did get the diagnosis, though, boom, first thing I did, Google. I put in autism, and I started my
research. God for Google.
I'm telling you.
Thank God for Google.
The University of Google is where I got my degree from.
Problem is, the University of Google sucks, because anyone can teach there, no matter how dishonest, how superstitious, how ignorant. On the University of Google, you can also learn about how the U.S. government blew up the World Trade Center, how crystals magically heal, how Jews kill Gentile infants for their blood, and how easy it is to get rich in real estate. Apart from her Google degree, McCarthy cites the evidence of her own family. Her son, Evan, was diagnosed with autism in 2005. After having treated him for years as a spiritually endowed New Age indigo child, she decided that he had instead been poisoned by vaccines and processed food. Thus, she has used her media platform to prescribe so-called detox diets and agitate against the most life-saving medicines in human history. As she told Oprah, "My science is named Evan." So ABC hired this woman to talk to millions of other women every weekday. Now look, this is America. McCarthy is entitled to say any stupid thing she wishes to, but how can a television network be so cynical as to enable her? As long as McCarthy is treated as a credible voice, the anti-vaccine canard will not die. Unvaccinated children, however, will. As Brendan Nyhan observed in the Columbia Journalism Review, the damage is already being done. Such news organizations as the Philadelphia Inquirer, USA Today, Salon, and the Associated Press characterized McCarthy's misinformation as controversial. But there is no controversy. She is simply wrong. By dutifully reporting her ravings side by side with truth, they have framed anti-vaccine quackery as a debate. This latest outbreak of ABC's P.T. Barnumism. You'll recall that last week we played you Barbara Walters interviewing a fake Duchess of Cambridge, confers two lessons. One is that these people will do anything for ratings. The other is this. If you are a smoking hot Holocaust denier, get yourself an agent. This may be your time.
Coming up, we now get to hear our own government's broadcasts to the rest of the world. If we ask nicely.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Squarespace, dedicated to providing a simple way to create websites for those who are growing a business, starting a blog, or opening an online store. Squarespace provides templates and tools to create professional websites. Users create sites that are mobile-ready, which include 24/7 support, a domain name, and e-commerce, all on the same platform. For a free trial, visit squarespace.com/media.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The Smith-Mundt Act, passed in 1948, was intended to shield U.S. citizens from U.S. propaganda, or, if you like, public diplomacy. That is, the original law authorized the State Department to conduct public diplomacy in person, in print, and over the airwaves, but it also barred the dissemination of those materials on American shores because some lawmakers distrusted the State Department. One congressman said it was, quote, chock full of reds. Thus, our radios could never broadcast, say, Voice of America, which is overseen by the Broadcasting Board of Governors. Until now. The Smith-Mundt Modernization Act lifts that domestic broadcast ban a little, spurring BuzzFeed to charge that, quote, propaganda that was supposed to target foreigners can now be aimed at Americans. But Washington State Congressional Democrat and bill co-sponsor Adam Smith says not to worry.
The bar on the U.S. government doing domestic propaganda remains in place. What we amended was the ability of them, if asked, to provide that same content domestically. So one of the examples was that Voice of America had been providing in Somalia and in those areas a sort of a counter-radicalization method. And in Minnesota, where they have a substantial Somali population, they had asked, you know, well, can we have that information? Smith-Mundt barred them from providing it. So we amended it to say, if somebody asks, and if it's information that has already been created for an international audience, then yes, you can provide it. The government still cannot provide purely for domestic consumption any sort of information campaign. This was a very limited exception.
The internet is what has changed the conditions worldwide that prompted you to co-sponsor this amendment. But is it not equally true that, let's just say, those in the Somalian diaspora in Minnesota who wish to see information that is not coming from some radical Islamist group need but go onto the internet to find a drazillion sources of uninflected news and information from all over the world without the assistance of the Broadcast Board of Governors or any other arm of the state?
Yeah, I mean, look, there's 1,000 different sources. I just don't see why the Broadcast Board of Governors, what they're providing for a foreign audience, shouldn't be one of them. And that's the other thing about the notion of somehow the Broadcast Board of Governors having some sort of control over what information we as Americans receive. In this era, it's absurd. They are but one voice out of, gosh, tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands. But what they're providing for a foreign audience, if a domestic audience requests it, I see no reason why they shouldn't be able to hear it.
Okay. Now, you have been in Congress for 17 years. You have seen a number of administrations be granted certain powers and authority and immediately overreach. Are you not concerned that the State Department, either under the Obama administration or under a future administration, will use these revisions to do exactly what the BuzzFeeds of the world fear, which is to use State Department resources to try to influence the opinion of Americans in America?
Well, they would be violating the law if they did that. I mean, I'm always concerned about the executive branch violating the law. This law doesn't make it any easier to do that. I mean, they could have done that already. You can always violate the law. But the law here is very clear. Anything created purely for domestic consumption is illegal. Can't be done.
Congressman, thank you very much.
Thanks. Appreciate the chance.
Congressman Adam Smith of Washington co-sponsored the Smith-Mundt Modernization Act. So, was U.S. government domestic propaganda ever really that much of a threat? Absolutely, says historian Thomas Fleming, author of The Illusion of Victory, America in World War I. The First World War was the occasion for the government's most ruthless battle for American hearts and minds.
World War I is the war in which we can see where the federal government decided they had to control as much as possible of all the information that was going out to the public. And so in concert with an ex-newspaper man named George Creel, C-R-E-E-L, a very fascinating volcanic type character, President Wilson created the Committee on Public Information, which soon became a gigantic federal monster. And they had 150,000 people working for them by the time the war ended, which was didn't last that long. You know, it was only a year and a half. And yet it became a huge operation.
It was very much the Ministry of Propaganda.
There's no doubt about it. These people were into everything. They actually published an official federal newspaper, 32 pages, tabloid size, every day. It was a daily paper that went out to every newspaper in America.
Brooke, in her book, The Influencing Machine, talks about the Committee for Public Information and said that its role was to spread war fever by suppressing bad news and equating dissent with disloyalty.
everybody who wasn't enthusiastic about the war was liable to get in a lot of trouble under something called the Espionage Act, which Wilson had put through Congress. Anybody who said anything against the government or against Wilson in particular could be sentenced to jail. One farmer in the Dakotas, I'm not sure north or south, told a young man, don't join the army. This war is a lot of foolishness. He got 5 years in jail. If you were riding on a streetcar and you happened to say to the man next to you, I think President Wilson is an idiot, if he reported you to the Committee on Public Information or to the American Protective League, which was their enforcement arm, you could do a lot of time in jail.
And how did the government egg people on to denounce their neighbors and family members and friends? What did the propaganda look like?
They had a huge team of people who traveled around the country. They were called the Four-Minute Men. And very often you'd go to a movie and the screen would go dark and one of the Four-Minute Men would walk out and he'd give this rousing speech how we have to fight, we have to believe in America, we have to make the world safe, a democracy, all the cliches that Wilson had put into his speech declaring war. This was all drummed into the minds of people at every level, all the way across the nation.
During World War I, the propaganda machine was a vast juggernaut. What happened in World War II? How did Roosevelt try to influence public opinion?
World War II, we had a president who had been in Washington during World War I. Franklin D. Roosevelt had been Assistant Secretary of the Navy, and he really saw how the Wilson administration operated, and he realized it was a mistake, this whole thing. And he also felt that keeping the American public involved in the war and loyal to it was a matter of some fragility. So many people had emerged from World War I totally disillusioned. And so Roosevelt relied on voluntary participation by the media in promoting the war in various ways. One example that struck me as unusual, and I only discovered it after quite a lot of research, was that he persuaded them for the first 18 months of the war never to show a picture of a dead American soldier or sailor. And not until Life magazine had a cover with some dead American soldiers on an island that they had attacked in the South Pacific. By this time, thousands of Americans had been killed. But that was the first time that they allowed the public to see the reality of death in the war. But this was the general pattern. He did not use the kind of force and intimidation that Wilson relied on.
Now, after World War II, Congress, perhaps understanding the dangers of propaganda, passed the Smith-Mundt Act. As of this month, there has been a revision to the Smith-Mundt Act, which does permit, under certain circumstances, some foreign propaganda, that's to say Voice of America broadcast and so forth, to be rebroadcast in the United States. Do you see this as an ominous development?
No, I really don't. I think that as long as our own media is full-fledged and operating, they can correct any of the extremes to which a government organization might go. I can see why this new regulation has been put in. There are many immigrant groups in the United States from countries like Somalia who need to hear some of the propaganda that we are sending to Somalia. They're now trying to become Somalian Americans, but they don't have access to a great deal of reporting on their individual country. But this would be corrected by the Voice of America being able to reach their radios and television.
Tom, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Tom Fleming is author of The Illusion of Victory, America in World War I.
Hier spricht die Stimme Amerikas.
Heute und täglich von heute an.
This is a voice speaking from America. Daily at this time, we shall speak to you about America and the war. The news may be good or bad. We shall tell you the truth.
That's from one of the earliest broadcasts of Voice of America, launched 71 years ago. According to its website, it reaches a weekly audience of 134 million people in 43 languages, and its practitioners would probably resent the word propaganda ever being applied to its broadcasts. Certainly Alan Heil would. He worked there from 1962 to 1998, acting as foreign correspondent, chief of news and current affairs, and deputy director of programs. Back then, VOA reached fewer people in more languages. We spoke to him 10 years ago, after the publication of his book, Voice of America, A History. He agrees that it was created more to influence than to inform, but its journalists didn't always stick with the program.
True, it was founded as a propaganda organization to counter Axis propaganda, particularly in Germany, but also in Japan. But you had at the very beginning, among the pioneers, those who believed that the best policy was to tell the truth. I can remember the story of General Stilwell, for example, who said, "The Japanese gave us a hell of a beating in Burma." Now, that became a matter of some contention, as you might imagine, between the policymakers in Washington and those broadcasting the news from the Voice of America then in New York. But the VOA staff held its own. And later we learned, following World War II, from some of the Japanese who were interrogated about their listening experiences, that made them really believe the Voice of America. Even in the early going, there were editors who stood behind the contract with the listeners to give them an honest accounting of the day's events.
You quote President Lyndon Johnson saying, "I know I can't affect the broadcast companies. I know they won't listen to me. I know they won't help me. But God damn it, I have my own radio, and I've got to make that work." And he was referring to the VOA and its coverage of Vietnam. Wouldn't you admit that sometimes the VOA has a problem reconciling its dual roles as both a government agency and an impartial news source?
Well, John Chancellor said that the Voice is at the crossroads of journalism and diplomacy. I think, however, it's increasingly clear, and particularly in the 21st century and in the post-9/11 period, that there is no substitute for a full and fair disclosure of events. I think that there is a hunger for the straight story.
How many languages is the VOA broadcast in?
It's broadcast now in 54 languages.
And do you count special English among them?
Not really. Special English, being a variant of standard English, was designed back in 1959 to aid comprehension of those listeners for whom English was a second language.
It was an English that was composed of a 1,500-word vocabulary.
Quite correct, and slowly delivered, one thought per one sentence.
And what could you convey in special English?
Oh, you would be remarkably surprised. If I may, I'd like to read from page 279 of the book.
Please.
The absolutely marvelous poem sent to us by A.V.B. Menon of Tamil Nadu in India, and he called it an ode to special English. "Hail thee, special English! Thou art a virgin maiden, uncorrupted, simple, easy. Ye ring a familiar tone to one and all, learned and wise, as much to the uninitiated. Simple is beautiful. No frills, no twists, nor pretensions. Ye wind your way to the heart to strike a familiar chord. It's neither the king's nor the queen's, but that of very common folk. It is a symphony in prose. Long live special English."
You know, it reminds me of one of VOA's greatest contributions to world culture isn't in language at all, but in music. I think that the most famous and certainly most beloved voice of the Voice of America is probably that of Willis Conover.
Absolutely. He once made a visit to Moscow, got out into the great packed hall in the center of the city, and all he said was, the standard introduction to his signature program.
Time for Jazz. Willis Conover in Washington with the Voice of America Jazz Hour.
And the hall burst into applause. This is at the height of the Cold War. And there was a standing ovation that lasted for several minutes.
Let's talk about the VOA in China during Tiananmen Square.
There's a fascinating story about one of the Chinese correspondents, Betty Zhou, who all she needed to do was to identify herself at the edge of this square of 1 million people, and suddenly the people would part like the waves of the Red Sea and usher her right up into the center and the platform where the pro-democracy demonstrators were holding forth during those very, very critical months leading up to June 3rd, 1989. The voice was then jammed by the Chinese government.
This is the Voice of America. The following program is in Chinese.
And then anyone listening to it can see the critical impact of jamming on blocking information from the Chinese people.
从天上晚发动争取民主自由运动的学生和支持学生的群众仍久留在平安门口。
I think even the Chinese themselves conceded before that martial law was imposed on that day in May of 1989 that the Voice probably had 60 million listeners. It was, I think, clear that its impact was historic in 1989.
One last question, Mr. Heil. We have the BBC. We have CNN everywhere. We've got the internet reaching into corners where even CNN can't reach. Why do we need the VOA?
I would have to go and quote David Burke, who was the first chairman of the U.S. Broadcasting Board of Governors, who said that CNN can be seen in hotel lobbies and in industrialized society. It cannot be seen in refugee camps. The U.S. simply has to have a voice, I believe, and that's a voice that reflects us. It's not a voice that's an official radio as much as it is one that reflects America, an American optic, as a West African editor once put it.
Alan Heil, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Alan Heil is the author of Voice of America, A History.
Hello, everybody. And all of you at Voice of America, congratulations on 70 years of extraordinary service. From that very first broadcast during World War II, and ever since, the Voice of America has been the voice of freedom. Long before we even talked about the power of public diplomacy, you made it your mission to help America communicate with the world, to show the true character of our country and the ideals and liberties for which we stand.
Coming up, Axis Sally betrays her country, and I get in a mess myself.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. Support for On the Media also comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, with Kids Count, national, state, and local data on the well-being of kids at datacenter.kidscount.org. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at GatesFoundation.org, and Wix.com, enabling over 30 million local businesses to create customized websites with the Wix website builder at WIX.com. This is NPR.
On the Media is supported by Squarespace, dedicated to providing a simple way to create websites for those who are growing a business, starting a blog, or opening an online store. Squarespace provides templates and tools to create professional websites. Users create sites that are mobile-ready, which include 24/7 support, a domain name, and e-commerce, all on the same platform. For a free trial, visit squarespace.com/media.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Sponsored content is something that's been around for as long as we've had media that need paying for. If you've ever watched a television infomercial or read a special advertising section in a fashion magazine, you too have consumed a bit of sponsored content, lately referred to as native advertising. And as the news industry continues to struggle for dollars, you will no doubt be seeing more and more native advertising alongside the news. This is potentially dangerous territory, as sponsored content is often made to resemble actual content as much as possible. Steve Rubell is chief content strategist at Edelman, the global public relations firm. He's authored a new report addressing these very murky public relationships. Remember the uproar earlier this year over a sponsored post about Scientology on the Atlantic website? Rubell says he knows why that native advertising puff piece was so jarring. It was in the wrong environment.
We had this self-serving, positive piece that was next to very thoughtful debate, scholarly sometimes, discourse, and it just wasn't the right fit. It was too distant from what the editorial formats are there already. Now, if it was the Church of Scientology trying to shape a debate around an issue and they had multiple points of view and they basically funded the piece of content and had their viewpoint along with others in that mix, I think it would have been a better fit.
You describe in your report a number of different ways that branded content or sponsored content can manifest itself. Can you tick down the list of ways that this can be accomplished?
So the first is what we're calling syndication. That is like the Scientology example. It is like the advertorial reinvented, where you're in a site that has a bunch of news articles, and somewhere in the middle of that list is a piece of content that the brand or one of their agencies create that sits in that mix. We're not sure about the long-term viability of that particular format. We think that people will skip over it. They see a piece of sponsored content, that might mean don't read. The second we're calling integration, and that's the product placement format that worked on TV reinvented for the web. We've had one publisher say, we do a list of 10 things you need to know about today. Number 11 could be from you, the sponsor. It's ideally created in the spirit of what's already on that site. BuzzFeed is one of the more advanced companies here. Their entire business model is to create these mini-sponsored listicles, if you will, list articles.
There is a third category of paid content, paid co-creation. What's that?
That's actually the cleanest one. That's where a media company wants to have a vertical in an area, say, about the future of business or about family travel, but they don't have the money to cover it. So they will create a special section that isn't just a one-off, but would live on a regular basis. The marketer basically commits to some degree to fund that. The media company commits a editorial person to that section that the sponsor has no dialogue with. They are just creating content in that sector, say on the future of business. We liken it to a baseball stadium where a sponsor comes in and acquires naming rights for, you know, 10 years, and it's the most expensive of the approaches, but it's also probably the most idealistic one because there is an equal win for all three parties involved if it's done well.
I had a sickening experience recently where I appeared on HuffPost Live, the web TV version of Huffington Post, and the subject was car advertising or something like that.
Today, we're continuing our conversation on luxury, and we're talking to some experts and veterans of the marketing and advertising world about reaching different audiences abroad. Joining us in our Google Hangout, we have Bob Garfield, author of Can't Buy Me Like, and host of NPR's On Media and writer for Media Post. David Kiley, editor-in-chief of AOL Autos. Holly Palika, senior vice president of strategy at Collective Bias. And back in studio with me, we have our friend Jim Verpilot, the director of marketing for Cadillac, which is a partner of HuffPost Live and is, of course, a brand that is synonymous with luxury. It's great to have you all here.
It turns out that Cadillac was the sponsor of this piece. It was agreed beforehand that Cadillac would have its people on the piece and that Cadillac cars would be featured within it. And I've been sucked into that dynamic, and it was sickening.
All the more reason why having this discussion around ethics is important. It's a matter of just being very clear all around, all sides, not the least of which is the audience and what is happening, where and why.
So it is all murky, but still in all, you recommend some primary best practices. What are they?
So there's a set of ideals that relate to the creation of the content, the transparency around that, and also the process for people to consider that are mostly for us. We are going to prefer to work with companies that kind of err on the side of disclosure and are really upfront in what is taking place and why. And the media companies, the sales side and the editorial side, are very separated. We are going to separate the parts of our business. So we're going to make sure that people who are working with journalists day to day are not also negotiating paid media buys.
Ideals is a pretty good word because they take place in an ideal world. At this moment in the history of native advertising, if you'll forgive me, the best practices that you've promulgated sound to me kind of like pieties that ignore the inherent structural problem of advertorial, which by its very nature is first trying to exploit borrowed interest from the surrounding editorial, you know, a halo effect that it may in no way deserve, and at worst, just try to trick the reader. You talked about labeling. That is such a classic example of why this may be an insoluble problem. On the one hand, the marketers want as little labeling as possible because otherwise people, as you say, skip over the material. And the media are conflicted because they want to accommodate the marketers and make the sale. And therefore, they use just enough disclosure to offer sort of plausible deniability, but still make it very easy for readers to be confused, to trick them, in effect. Are these problems that can be solved?
They have to be solved because the media has no other means to monetize right now. I don't think that this is something they're running to because they are excited about it. I think they're running to it because they feel that they need to offset those other financial pressures. And there's also a cost pressure for them, too, is they have to continue to build out for new platforms like social networks, for example, and mobile that they didn't have to build out before. So the solving of this issue is primarily a publisher problem, but we believe that marketers and the public need to also be equal parties to this discussion because what we all want to see is a viable press that continues to do what it's done for hundreds of years, but maybe finds a way to borrow the best of what has worked on social networks and search engines as a business model. People there seem to know that those kinds of ads are what's required to support a free service. I feel like it's in everybody's best interest to somehow make this work if we want to see a viable free press.
Steve, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob.
Steve Rubell is Chief Content Strategist at the global PR firm Edelman.
We've spent a lot of time this hour on the practice and the ethics of persuasion. Hiding advertising messages under the mantle of journalism is not ethical, but it's legal. Out-and-out propaganda against Americans by Americans is neither. On March 10th, 1949, a jury found Mildred E. Gillers guilty of treason. She died 25 years ago last month. Many of the people who knew her late in life, years she spent quietly in Ohio, had no idea of her past. They didn't know that between 1942 and 1945, Gillers was better known to the world as Axis Sally, a Berlin-based radio host on German state TV, broadcasting Nazi propaganda.
And the enemies are precisely those people who are fighting against Germany today, and in case you don't know it, indirectly against America too. Because a defeat for Germany would mean a defeat for America. Believe me.
In 2011, we spoke to historian Richard Lucas about his biography of Gillers called Axis Sally, the American Voice of Nazi Germany.
Her broadcasts were basically two-pronged. One to American women at home, and also her broadcasts were aimed at the American soldiers fighting on the front lines.
And the messages for the people on the front lines?
We know where you are. We know you're coming and you're going to be destroyed. The other messages included your girlfriends, your wives are home with the four Fs, the slackers, and are being romanced by them.
Frequently in her broadcasts to the Americans at home, she's exhorting them to use a kind of tough love to defy the country.
If your child behaves badly, do you agree with his misbehavior? Do you say to yourself, my child, right or wrong, I don't care what he does? No, you don't. You try to correct that child. You try to make him a better citizen. And what is a country? A country is only made up of people, after all. Do you say my country, right or wrong? No, girl. That's false sentimentality. And I do not say my country, right or wrong. I love America. But I do not love Roosevelt and all of his kite boyfriends who have thrown us into this awful turmoil.
She would broadcast the names and injuries or deaths of soldiers. She would say to their mothers or wives, that's what you get for supporting the war.
Yes, and I have some examples of that here.
Mm-hmm.
How many very mutilated boys have I seen? And they've said to me, I don't care how I get back, just so I get back. You see, that's the way they think now. What do you suppose they'll think in later years when there are no jobs for cripples? And it goes on. She tells a mother whose wounded son is in a German hospital, well, Mrs. Leupold, you've seen nothing of this war. You only read Jewish propaganda in your newspaper, but if you've been listening to this broadcast, then you know that for many weeks I went from war hospital to war hospital, and I saw your boys. There are hundreds and hundreds of thousands of them scattered all over the world, asked to sacrifice their youth, asked to sacrifice their future, because when they get back, they will be in no state to take up a job of any consequence.
Okay, who was Mildred Gillers? I know she had a lousy childhood.
She did have a terrible childhood. She lost her biological father at the age of 7. Her stepfather was an itinerant dentist who became addicted to alcohol and the laughing gas in his practice. And I also found that she perhaps was abused as the stepdaughter, sexually abused. She could not wait to get away from the stepfather, and she went to Ohio Wesleyan University and came under the influence of a man who told her that she should pursue acting. And she went to Cleveland with $20 in her pocket, and she became an actress. And then within a year, she went to Broadway. And she was in George White's Scandals, the vaudeville show.
So things were going pretty well.
On and off, yes. But she had this innate ability to mess up a good situation. She always wanted to do Shakespeare and Ibsen. If it was comedic material, she didn't want to remain there. And at that point, 1929, 1930, when the Great Depression took hold and vaudeville was dying, it all fell apart. She became involved with a man, British and Jewish, and he was a foreign officer for Britain. He was assigned to Algiers, and she followed him to Algiers. And after that relationship fell apart, she went to Europe, met her mother, and they ended up in Berlin, 1934. And that's where she sees the Third Reich in its infancy, sees the enthusiasm, sees the employment opportunities, and she decides to stay.
She later said that she feared poverty in the U.S., and she wanted a German man that she'd been dating to marry her.
Yes. In 1941, she was counseled by the U.S. consulate to return back to the United States. She had just started working for the Nazi radio, and she was involved with a man named Paul Erickson. He was a German citizen, and he told her, if you return to the United States, I will never marry you. She was already 40 years old at the time. She decided to remain, and then when Pearl Harbor occurred, she was in a position where she could not go back. Paul Erickson, the fiancé who was going to marry her, was sent to the Eastern Front and killed.
And that was that. And she was stuck.
Yes. And then Max Otto Koischwitz, a former Hunter College professor who fled back to Germany with his entire family in 1939, right before the outbreak of World War II, became her manager. They had an illicit affair. He was married with 3 daughters and 1 on the way. He wrote her scripts, directed her propaganda, encouraged her, even telling her that Shakespeare was propaganda.
When she finally went on trial, did her prosecutors present evidence of her impact?
One by one, prisoners of war and families of prisoners of war had come out to say that their families had heard the broadcasts. There were witnesses from Germany who were called to testify that they were eyewitnesses to her treachery. In the court, the judge and prior court cases had said it didn't matter whether anyone at all had heard her broadcasts. It didn't matter if she said it on a microphone and no one heard it at all. She's still liable for treason.
And she apparently gave the performance of her life during her trial.
She did. And when the prosecution played a recording of her saying, "American mothers, did you raise your sons to be murderers?" She collapsed in the court.
You think she really fainted?
No. She had a habit of swooning when it got a little tight.
How'd you feel about her at the end of this project?
Conflicted. You can see in her time in prison how she changed.
How many years in prison?
12.
And what was the change?
She was a racist and anti-Semite when she came in, didn't want anything to do with the other women. She was totally unrepentant. She was actually put in Alderson Prison in West Virginia, where Martha Stewart served her term. And she changed over that time. She converted to Roman Catholicism. She started to teach the other women in the prison. She ran the choir for the Protestants and the Catholics. And I really believe that she had a true conversion. By the same token, she still denied knowing anything about the Holocaust till the day she died.
On the day she was found guilty, she said to reporters, "I wish those who judge me would be willing to risk their lives for America the way that I did." Did she vary from that position?
No, she never varied from that position.
So let me ask you, Richard, why are you conflicted?
I'm conflicted because I believe that there is redemption, and I believe she had some measure of it. I believe that she changed remarkably in her later years. When you spend the first two-thirds of your life seeking nothing but fame and spend the last third seeking nothing but obscurity and privacy, I think you've changed, and changed in a major, major way.
Richard, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Richard Lucas is a historian and author of Axis Sally, the American voice of Nazi Germany.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, PJ Vogt, Alex Goldman, Sara Abdurkhman, and Chris Neary. We had more help from Olivia Wheats and Molly Buckley. And the show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Andrew Dunn.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news and our boss. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Axis Bobby.
Thank you.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. Support for On the Media also comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Thanks for listening to this week's On the Media podcast, a free service of WNYC Radio. Find out where On the Media is playing in your area and support your local public radio station by going to onthemedia.org. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.